I have these friends, Dan and Sheila. Actually, they're podcast hosts.
Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redden.
And we are back for two more episodes of Millennium. The last two before we get to talk about my favorite episode of Millennium.
Oh, well, these ones were interesting. They were two very different.
Oh, incredibly different, but very good episodes. And one of them is very intriguing for stuff it sets up that we're going to talk about payoff later.
Yes.
But is very interesting.
Yeah, the first one could have been an episode of a regular episode of, Criminal Minds or...
Well, kind of, except for, there is a supernatural element to it. But there literally is an episode of Criminal Minds about someone stealing a school bus full of children. So you're not wrong.
But this has the overlay that was just...
Yeah. Very well done.
I tell you, the punchline is just like, whoa.
It's fantastic. It really is.
Yeah, when we get there, we'll talk about it. But the punchline was just like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but the important part is it opens with a guy watching, 10 televisions at once, right? And listening to the radio and looking over, news and just trying to figure out a message. And he has scrawled it everywhere.
Yep. He has chronologies and he has
his giant conspiracy board that he has built. And according to the conspiracy board, he has figured out what his role is.
Yes.
Like he understands how he fits into all of these stories. And it's like, so essentially the code is, if you were just watching an episode of Criminal Minds, it's like, okay, here's the form that this man's delusion is taking.
Yes.
That is what we are being asked to believe. Of course, since this is an episode of Millennium, it's much more complicated than that.
It's very complicated.
Oh my God.
It's funny. I think I must have forgotten it because I did as I was going along. Right?
Yeah.
I could sort of work some, but what is the sign, and when you get to the end, but I did figure it out before we got to the end.
Oh, I remembered the episode. That's the weird part is like the synopsis I didn't remember, but when I'm watching the episode, I'm like, oh no, I remember this episode. I got it.
Yeah. And you watch him and he's, and it's sort of like it's time and he, you see, he's living in this long trailer.
Yep.
I'm trying to figure out where he got all his electricity from, but.
Yeah, there's a cable somewhere. Who knows? That doesn't matter. He's got a generator, it's possible.
Yeah. Anyway, it was very, so it just opens up with him working through all of this stuff, and figuring it's time.
Yeah.
So we don't know what it's time for and we cut the credits.
And then next thing you know, Frank's arriving with Peter Watts to look over, and he's looking over pages and pages of missing children pictures. All right, this is the one thing I'll say is, like, I wasn't super clear on the timeline. They got all those pictures of those kids together real fast for those missing persons photos.
Well, it's a small town.
It's a small town, you're right.
And they probably got it from the photographer that took the children's pictures for the year.
Yeah, there you go. That makes sense.
It would have been pretty easy to get those pictures together.
That makes sense. I'm not going to argue with you on that front.
No.
But anyway, they got all the pictures of these kids together.
Yeah.
That's the key part. And we find out that 17 kids are missing. And the school bus driver. And they're like, did the school bus driver kidnap them? And they're like, no way. No, he's driven the school bus for 25 years. No one thinks that he's involved in this, even in the slightest. Like, that's dismissed immediately out of hand. And they right away find the school bus, which has been dropped into a river. And I gotta say, the production design, the level that goes into this show, you're actually watching them drag a bus out of a river, right? And then they actually filled this bus up with dirty water, you know, so that when they opened up the doors, the production designers, like it all just comes, all the swampy water comes rushing out. And you're like, I don't know that I've seen this much work put into a TV show.
Look, I love it. I love it because we don't have to worry about, okay, did they make that choice because there was no money left in the budget?
I know, right? Well, I've said it before. I'll say it again. This is the kind of stuff you can do on a TV show when you don't have 9 cast members.
Yes.
You know, when you're paying 9 salaries every week, when you're paying people, 9 people, $50,000 a week to be on your show or more, right? Yeah. There's a lot of stuff you can't do, but when you just got one guy there.
Yep.
Carrying the entire show on his back, and sometimes Peter Watts is there.
And sometimes Lara is there.
And sometimes Laura Means is there. Although, I mean, you know, she's not there that often, but she's in it enough, for where they're going with her character, which we're not going to spoil for people who haven't seen it.
No, it is, yes. And this is, so it comes out, they have left, they show us the pictures of the bus, you have,
but the important part is the kids are not on the bus.
No, the kids aren't on the bus. Nobody's dead.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, and they're walking, you know, as Frank Black and Peter Watts are walking in the bus, Peter says, well, the best you can hope for is they're not on the bus.
Yep.
And then they walk in and going, we got the best you could hope for.
Yep.
None of the children are on the bus. The bus driver isn't on the bus.
Yeah.
So, for sure.
So, I mean, it's not a lead, but at least the kids aren't dead. That is what they're thinking. It's not a lead yet, but at least the children aren't dead. So they've still got some hope. And so Frank looks over the children's possessions and, notably one of the kids' last names is Casey, which is of course, a reference to Edgar Casey, famous, doomsday prophet, the sleeping psychic who had dreams of,
Millennium.
Dreams of the end of the world. So yeah. a little thing there for people who pay attention to the kind of mythology that this show is built around.
Yes. And the thing is the sheriff is beside himself. He shouldn't even be on this job.
Yeah.
Because his daughter is one of the
missing kids.
And yeah. The daughters, I am assuming it is the daughter. Is her last name the Gacy name? Yes.
The Casey. Yeah.
Jessica Gacy.
Casey. But yes. Yeah, that's the sheriff as well.
That's the sheriff's, right, daughter. Mm-hmm. So they find all some of these things.
Yeah, because all of their possessions were left on the, were left on the bus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like none of that stuff was taken. All of their backpacks, because they were on their way to school. So all of their backpacks, all of their personal possessions, it was all just left.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's the key, right? Is like, they were just taking the kids.
Yep.
And the bus driver. And so Frank says, okay, well, obviously, you know, the kids had to have been moved onto another vehicle. So we've got to check up the road to see where the switch happened. So they find, the place up the road where the car was parked, where the van was parked. And Frank walks through how the kidnapping happened and we see it happen in real time. And it's a very nice little scene.
Yeah.
It's all very well done. And then you get the great moment where they immediately identify that it's gotta be, they see some white paint transfer on the emergency door. Yeah. Right? Cause Frank is like, they backed the van up and just ushered the kids from one vehicle to another without letting them get out because that minimizes their chances to run away, which makes perfect sense. And so they immediately put out a call for a white van. Or a white, you know, box truck or something small.
Yeah.
And they get one. And we have a car chase.
And we find some storm chasers.
And it's just some storm chasers, because they think there's going to be a tornado in the area. And so they are rushing to get their scanning equipment into place before it gets here. And by the way, again, this is a show that's really good at setup and payoff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and this guy tells them, this is going to be a really bad one. He said, I should tell you.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, you know, because they do explain. He said that this is going to be really bad.
Yeah, it's going to be a really bad one. So anybody you like, make sure whatever you're looking for, make sure everybody gets undercover because this is going to be a bad storm coming.
Yeah.
Which is a nice moment. And again, show's great at setup and payoff. It really is.
Yeah. And the setup is, well, no, we'll go along.
We'll get there when we get there.
Yeah. Well, it sets up different things. Like if you were paying attention, which obviously we are a second time around, right? Shall we see the children? Next, right? We see the children being moved.
Yeah.
Into a bunker.
Yeah.
It looks like underground.
Mm-hmm. They're being moved into a buried storage container.
Yes. And, all of them are just slowly. And if you're paying attention, you're going, okay, so somebody's getting them away from the storm, but.
Yeah, but that's the show in no way triggers that. Like the show way in no way tips you off to that whatsoever.
No, but second time around, you're going.
Oh yeah, it's clear what's happening second time around. But again, that's because the show is great at setup and payoff.
Yeah. So the children are all downstairs, down in the bunker.
Yeah.
The bus driver is there.
Bus driver's there too. He's been injured.
And they count. He counts the children.
Yes.
And
this great moment.
Yes. There are only 17.
Yeah.
And Ty says, but this won't work if it isn't all 18.
Yep.
And then he really injures the bus driver because he needs to know who the
wasn't child. Yep.
Or it won't work is all he says. Right? So he goes back. To find the 18th.
Well, and Frank has also figured out that, someone was missing today.
Yeah.
And so he says, who is missing? And so now there's a race to who is going to get to this kid first.
Yeah.
And so they have, so they rush out to the house. The kidnappers rush out to the house. The cops are rushing out to this. The kidnappers are rushing out to this. They all they all converge at the same time. There's a fight, the guy who was doing the actual prophesying, right, gets captured and almost killed. But Frank is like, you can't kill him. We need to find the kids.
And a stupid sheriff who
is just so, should not be there, but yeah, cause he's way too emotionally involved, says you can't kill him. We need his help to find these kids, which is yes, absolutely, Frank. Thank God somebody's paying attention.
Yes. And the other kidnapper.
But unfortunately has managed to escape with the 18th child.
Yeah, the 18th child.
Meaning a total of 19 people have been kidnapped. And that's the key number. Because again, the show is called, the episode is called 1919.
So
that's the key thing you have to remember, because 19 people were abducted.
Yes. Anyway, so off they go. And, they have the guy, he's in custody. They do find his trailer.
Yep.
And Frank goes in with Peter and Frank is looking at all of this and Peter's looking at it. And then Frank says, you got to call in Laura.
Yeah.
Well, no, this isn't her thing. She's just a forensic psychologist. And Frank says, yes, but you have to understand we're in the middle of this man's mind.
Yeah. Exactly. Like this, what looks like the path, like just this nonsense to us is how he thinks.
Yes.
And we get Laura there, which is great. And then we see that she has recreated, his insanity board in this interrogation cell. Right. But the guy is sitting there obsessively going over it because she has put in mistakes.
Yes.
She has copied it poorly. Because she knows that that is going to trigger him. That like and nothing would trigger his obsessive compulsion more than seeing someone getting his stuff wrong.
And so Frank is with him.
Yeah.
Because the other guy, of course, wants to beat him up, the sheriff, of course.
Yeah.
And Frank is with him and talking with him and fixing things for him.
Yeah.
Right? And then, you know, and Laura says, no, we're only going to find things out if he's willing to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Then Frank tries to talk and he isn't going to tell Frank where the children are. What he does say is, until I get a sign.
Yeah.
He said, are the children all right? He said, well, if I get the sign, everything will be fine. Right? Otherwise, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? So the children are mm-hmm. either going to be fine, whatever this sign is, the children are going to be fine if he gets his sign,
if the sign shows him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we cut back and we see that the children have been taking it upon themselves to try and escape.
Yes.
Led by the sheriff's daughter by, and this is a very good trick, piling up all of the mattresses that they had been left to sleep in. Cause again, these people are not uncivilized as far as kidnappers go. By the standards of kidnappers, they seem like okay guys. But just as they've finished piling up all the mattresses, right? Just as they finish piling up all the mattresses, the other kidnapper comes and finishes completely burying them. So there will be no escape.
Yes. Three heavy. I had forgotten, right? But I'm going, God, are those oil drums filled with oil? And he's covered the air hole.
Yep. He's even covered the air hole. It is a 100% sealed off now.
Yes. And so, and you see that Jessica again is sort of taking the lead along. Well,
she's basically running things down there to the point where she has to like drag the bus driver out of his self-pity and get his help because the kids aren't going to be strong enough to lift the top off of it.
Yes. And then when somebody starts to talk, she says, no, don't talk because we need to save the air.
Yep. Yeah. She's right? On top of things quite clearly.
Yes, quite clearly she's on top of things, and so I'm going,
I see what's going on there.
She's the one, is she?
That's the implication being made.
Yeah, that's the implication being there, because he did say something, you know.
Well, no, because in the conversation, right, that Frank has with the lead kidnapper, we start learning about revelation,
mm-hmm.
right? We start talking about revelation and a war that's coming, because Frank has had these recurring images of an atomic bomb going off.
Yes. And the war will only be stopped if one of these children is the one.
Yeah. Can become a peacemaker.
Yes. Now we have 1919 and it's Revelation 1919.
Exactly.
And so if this is the peacemaker
mm-hmm.
is going to come, if that person, and he, boy or girl, he doesn't know, he has no idea.
Who it is.
But if it is among these 18 children, then, you know, the sign will tell him, basically. Yeah,
exactly. Oh my God. So, but as he starts talking about it, Laura notices, right?
Yes.
Laura notices that, he scratches at his hand. Whenever he's telling the truth about something, whenever he's talking about the kidnapping.
Except that he won't say the word children, so whenever somebody else says
brings it up, he's so stressed about what he's done to these children that he's worrying at his skin.
Yes.
And so her idea is that if we could just get him close to where the children are hidden, he would start freaking out so much, we would know exactly where they were. The problem is, they could be anywhere. Except, and this is the key, and I really like this part, they do, you know, the whole dirt, the dirt analysis from his clothes. Yeah. Leading to a great moment where Peter Watts has to like, get in a crop duster and fly the hour to the nearest city where they can have it analyzed. Not excited about getting on that plane. No,
but Frank ain't going, so.
Frank ain't going, so yeah, somebody's got to, and it's gonna be Peter. So they get it, and they find out there's a bunch of bauxite in that, and of course, bauxite is how you make aluminum. They're like, and there is an old, quarry for bauxite at the edge of town. And so they're like, boom, done. Let's drive him over there. And they do. Right?
Yeah.
But when they get there, he does start worrying his hands just as, Laura predicted he would. But, his partner also starts shooting at them.
Yes.
Oof. And so they have a gunfight. The partner gets shot at. They get shot at. And while all this is going on,
the tornado comes.
The tornado shows up.
And so Frank and them have to get behind something and hang on to something.
Yeah. They have to get under all of like these old concrete bases, like these old concrete pylons.
Yeah.
You know, hoping. And whereas the kidnapper just puts up his hands and walks right out into the,
Yeah. And he's watching and watching and I'm going, oh, the tornado.
Yeah. That's the sign he was waiting for.
He's waiting for not the tornado. It's that the tornado went right over where the children were.
Yep.
It turned over all of the oil bin drips. Mm-hmm. It wiped it all out and he's got a smile on his face and the tornado takes him away.
Yeah. The tornado takes him away. And so then the air clears. The air clears, the tornado goes away and we find out that the other guy was killed by a piece of flying debris.
Yeah. And the sheriff is all upset because now they have no way
of ever finding the kids.
Yeah, except
the tornado has dug out, has like very cleanly, completely dug out the container they're in, leaving it totally uncovered.
With a big hole in it so the children can walk out.
Yeah, that's the thing. It even pulled off the lid of the thing.
So the children.
The tornado set them free.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, well, at least, you know, all's well that ends well, happy ending. And then we find out the kicker that this unbelievably powerful tornado destroyed the school.
Yeah.
It came out of nowhere. There was no time for a tornado warning. Had all the kids been in school that day, they all would have been killed by the tornado. And that's the end of the episode. Is Laura saying, what, you think these guys saved these kids? And Frank just shrugs. Because he's like, I don't know. Because, by the way.
What do you think?
What do you think? That is how episodes of Millennium end. With Frank shrugging saying, I don't know what's going on here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's all you can, the only assumption you can make is that however this man became obsessed with this, he saved those children's lives.
Yep. He became like he found whatever message he found in Revelation, right?
And all of this stuff that he's been listening to for 2 or 3 years.
Yep. However he found that message, he got the correct message and those children were saved.
Yep. All of them because he said, I don't know which one is going to be the peacemaker.
Yep.
I don't know. But if we don't,
we lose our chance to essentially save the world.
Yeah, I guess what he found out was that there was a child in that particular town that was going to be a peacemaker and could help stop the war.
The end of the world. Yeah.
And the end of the world. World War III and the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But he didn't know which child.
No. And he knew that they were at risk.
Yeah. So he kidnaps them.
So he kidnaps all of them to keep the tornado from killing them.
Yeah. And so
it's a crazy episode.
It's a crazy episode, and we all know, because we've watched the episode, that it is Jessica. Somehow or another, Jessica is going to save the world.
Mm-hmm. That's the only conclusion you can come to watching it.
Yeah. Even though she's got this god-awful father.
Yeah, he's not the best.
No, but he does love his daughter.
Well, that's clear.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a crazy episode.
Yeah, it is. It was really good.
It's thrilling all the way through. It's, it's edge of your seat. You don't know where it's going from minute to minute. Like all of the investigation stuff is very well written and very well handled. It's just a really solid episode from beginning to end. And it has a fantastic kicker that, you know, Millennium is so good at.
Yes. You know, all those biblical prophecies.
Yeah. We've actually found one of the people the biblical prophecies are referring to. Who could have guessed? No, I love this episode. I think it's really good. I think, we're big fans of him because of this, of Terry O'Quinn because of this show. But it's worth noting, like, and I guess this is why they didn't really need Bob, how good his chemistry
With Frank is.
Like, he and Lance Henriksen are so good together. They have such vastly different energies And you might think, oh, well, they're both just two, you know, restrained white guys. Yeah, that's true. They two are two just emotionally restrained white guys, but they're so different. They play these things so differently, right? And they're so good at bouncing off one another. No, I love the two of them together.
Yep. The writing is perfect. The acting is perfect. So
they're great.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, just a really good episode. And then we get,
the weirdest
episode of Millennium so far.
And we get who the Millennium Group actually is.
Yep. This is who we are.
This is who we are.
Yeah.
This is their phrase. This is the second time we've had phrases, right? Yeah. The first one was,
who cares?
He has come.
Yes, in that, I was talking about the opening credits and the fact that this is who we are is at the core of the opening credits now.
No. As I said, this is the second time we've gotten sort of these watch phrases.
The watchwords, yes.
Yeah, and this was, the opening was so...
This episode literally opens with like in the 11th century.
Yeah.
With people trying to execute guys who turn out to be members of the Millennium Group.
Yeah, well,
just running around speaking Latin in the 11th century.
Well, people did, if you were...
Of course they did, yeah.
It was still a living language.
Absolutely. Especially among religious scholars, as the Millennium Group members were.
Well, and they were, and they had... Right? So you have the two of them. They've got the hand of Saint Sebastian. And so they have to keep moving because they know they are being chased by the church.
Yeah.
Okay, the church is chasing them. And so then the one guy who's got the hand says, I'm gonna leave and go another way.
Yeah.
To his fellow member and the fellow member, and the two of them say, this is who we are, and off they go.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bunch of the group that is leaving to go, they hear horses coming because he makes this line. It's not, I mean, that's what's interesting. It's not the snake you can see. It's the snake in the grass.
Yep.
Right. And so of course what happens is the guy he was talking to, of course, was with the other guys, with the bad guys.
Yeah, with the Romans. And I call them the Romans. It's the Catholic Church. We all know who they are.
It's the Catholic Church who's chasing them. Because he goes and then he says, now we've got the hand and they'll be done. They've killed the guy.
Yep.
And he doesn't have the hand on him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's then
the hand is lost.
The hand is lost. We've got the opening credits.
Yeah. It's quite a weird way to start an episode of television.
Well, you don't know what's going on.
Nope.
No, because we have not heard the Millennium people say, this is who we are yet.
No, it's just been in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the opening credits, but you don't pay attention to what does that mean, you know?
No, not at all. Yeah. No, it's definitely just a weird thing that happens in the opening credits.
Yeah.
In the same, wait, worry, who cares, right? Yeah. Was in the first season. Like, you don't understand how important this is to what the show is saying and what the show's point is.
But now we know.
And now we're starting to get a glimpse into the world of the show.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And then of course, we have Peter Watts announcing that he's gonna go, that he's got something he needs to work on. And the group does not want him working on this.
No. And partly because, as Izzy says to Peter, look, if you have found this, they already know.
Yep.
And that is.
And that is a key message, that there is another group here.
There is another group here, and if you found this out, they already know it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they're trying to tell Peter not to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't. And Peter says, I have to, whatever. And then he walks out and he goes to Frank, and Frank's playing solitaire.
I know.
On his computer.
So perfect. He's just playing solitaire on his computer like any of us might.
Yeah.
Just waiting for a call, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, he can't be with his family right now, so he's completely inert as a person. If he's not working, he's not anybody. Like, he's a family man and he has his job. And if he can't be with his family and he doesn't, you know, and he's not working, who is Frank Black? I don't know that he has hobbies.
That's the big question, right?
I don't know that this is the kind of man who has hobbies.
No, he sort of did when he was fixing up his house at the beginning.
But, you know, how's it fixed now? It's not really a hobby per se. Yeah. But anyway, Peter shows up and he's like, look, I need your help with this thing. It's not for the group and it's risky. It's not for the group. And I'm asking you as a personal favor to me.
Yeah.
And Frank's like, sure. Cause again, Frank is just waiting for something to do.
So off they go to Berlin.
Yep. Oh my God. Love this.
Yeah, they get there and the guy they're supposed to meet has been killed.
Yep. Hey, did you recognize the detective? The guy playing the detective?
I should recognize him. He did look familiar, except that I cannot place the name.
All right. Here's a fun thing. He's the actor who played General Arkady Orimov, one of the villains in the movie GoldenEye. He's the guy who's in charge of Space Command in GoldenEye.
Yeah, okay.
Just big fan of that movie. I love me some GoldenEye. I think that's a great movie. I think it's one of the best James Bond movies. But yeah, that's who that was. In case you're wondering why you recognized him, that's why it is.
Like I'm going, he looks so familiar, but I watch a lot of sort of German TV. And
so yeah, there's any number of reasons you could have recognized why this guy.
And not actually know.
You wouldn't default to assuming it's a James Bond type of thing, but yes. No. Oh, what's great though is, he loves American detectives.
all I could think of was, Bakersfield.
I know. Oh my God. Bakersfield PD. The guy who became a cop because he loved cop shows.
Yeah.
He was desperate for his life. And he's listing off all the, you know, detectives like Kojak. And my favorite part is like, Tony Scali. And I know who that is. You know who that is. But I just love that Frank and Peter are like, the hell are you talking about? He's like, the commish. You know, the commish.
And when he says Book of Dano at some
Book
point.
Book of Dano. Oh my God. No, I love this character. It's such a, like, it's such a dark episode. And to have this comedy guy right at the heart of it is such a weird choice. But it's a good performance.
They get arrested because they're looking through everything and the beat cops arrest them, right?
Yeah.
And bring them in. And all of a sudden somebody's, you know, the cop at the police station has to go in and say, okay, yeah, you guys are okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah, look at everything we've got. And, okay. And here's the guy. That's how they meet the cop.
Yeah.
That's American, right? And it's so they go off. Okay. He's dead. So they have mm-hmm. to get to the computer, but Peter won't tell Frank what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, and so finally Frank just says, look, you know, we're having all these, you've got to tell me what's going on.
I trusted you enough to come here. You've got to trust me enough. You need my help. You got to trust me enough to tell me why.
So then Peter says, well, there's stuff I can't tell you, but I can tell you this much about the bog body.
Yeah. Because Frank has seen this body and he's like, probably been dead 20 years or something like that. And he's like, this body has been dead for 1,000 years.
Yeah,
because the peat moss preserved it.
Yeah, peat moss preserves, and they find every now and then people who've fallen into the peat moss. So, yeah. You know, and then they're walking down the street, and so Frank says, you know, we're being watched, and then the guys take off, and Peter says, yeah, but it's the ones you can't see that are
you have
still-
the snake in the grass, exactly. But then they go to their car, and hear a beeping.
And no, Frank sees a piece of,
is it wire or is it?
Electrical wire.
Yeah, electrical wire. He's like, what is this supposed to be connected to? And he's like, oh no.
The two of them look at one another and
run for it. Yeah. And just as the car explodes.
Yeah.
And so then you've got the higher up. They have to talk to the police again, obviously. Yeah. And the higher up is like, you're not planning to stay in Germany long, are you? And it's like, well, her visa is good for 6 months, so who knows? Such a great response.
Yeah.
Oh, such a good response. But anyway, it's great. And who comes there to make sure they get bailed out?
B.H. Pounder.
Yep. Cheryl Andrews, who was in Germany, coincidentally, teaching some kind of course to German police. And the group asked her to check on what Frank and Peter were up to, because again, they are not completely sold on this operation of Peter Watts's.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they have asked her to come and check on him.
Yeah. So Peter, being obsessed, has to go back.
Yeah.
Not talking to anybody, but particularly not telling Frank Watts, but he has to go back to the lab.
But before, but you forgot one moment, one note, which is we then cut to a hospital and find out the doctor isn't dead at all.
Yeah.
And he announces that he was assaulted and beaten half to death by Peter Watts.
Yes.
So that's our clip, but they go back to the lab, and in the lab, they're like, if we could just get into his computer, we could figure out, we could find out his research, because the doctor had been working essentially to figure out where the Hand of Saint Sebastian is.
Yeah.
To locate where these guys died, and so where the Hand of Saint Sebastian was. And Peter thinks they were getting close, and that's why somebody attacked him.
Yes.
So they go to the lab, and of course they can't make heads nor tails out of the computer, so they call up, Brian. Our beloved Brian Rodiker.
Yep.
To work on it for them. And who wants to make it absolutely clear that, you know, this is like golden time. He wants to be paid double for his work. Because this is not an official job and they're doing all sorts of illegal things.
Yep.
So he's like, so I'm going to need to be paid double because Brian's wonderful.
Yep. Downtime.
Oh yeah, exactly. And he's watching, because of the continuing thing with him, he's watching Planet of the Apes. Ah. Such a nice little beat that he's watching Planet of the Apes. But anyway, so what they find out is, right, that the doctor, right, is a pornography addict. Just had to the point where it's like, and Brian's like, if he's watching, you know, if he's enough of a porn zombie that he is watching stuff on his work computer, then obviously this is very important to him. So that's where you're going to want to search for his password.
Yeah.
So they find out who his most beloved porn star is. And yes, her name is his password. Which, you know, that's a perfectly logical line of thought from Brian. Makes perfect sense that he would guess that.
The days of simple passwords.
I know, right? Back when a password would be nice and simple. And so they're able to find his research. That's the key part. They're able to get into his research. But things get real weird because they get a message from like an online chat.
No, his favorite, Christy.
Yeah, the online chat of her group. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And that, because he regularly goes onto her website, and the online chat pops up and says, you know, it's like, mentions that he was there last night.
Yeah.
And that's the key part, because according to, you know, Peter and, as far as Peter and Frank know, this guy's been dead for a week.
Yep.
How was he there last night?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so they ask Brian to check into it. Right, they ask Brian to check into it, and they're like, he must be, and they quite reasonably assume he's being held, in a hospital under protective custody.
Yep.
And they ask, and so they go and they look into that, and they get to sneak in, and you know, Frank gets to do a nice thing of distracting a guy by claiming he doesn't speak German, or no, I'm saying not pretending, I'm sure he doesn't speak German. But it's like being, you know, the American tourist who needs help, and so Peter uses the distraction to go and talk to the doctor, who is now relieved to find out that, okay, the guy who beat him up was not in fact Peter Watts.
Yeah. And he must tell Peter something.
Yeah. And so he tells Peter something about, you know, essentially how to find the body.
Yeah.
Yeah. This episode moves. Like, this episode is so dense plot-wise.
Yeah. So he leaves. And
literally the moment Peter walks out the door, the guy who, the guy who had beat up the doctor previously shows up, murders the police guard, and kills the doctor.
Yep.
Finishes the job. Jesus. Oh, man. So they, oh my God. And this is where, we get into the psychic thing. And I always go back to that Lance Henriksen interview where he does not feel the character is psychic. And I'm like, Frank, this is a scene where your character decides the fact that he got sunk in quicksand is a message from God that this is where the body is buried.
Yep.
And you're right. Don't tell me your character isn't psychic.
No, 'cause he sees somebody running, right? He sees, and of course, Saint Sebastian, those of you who watch horror will know it's the one that got
riddled with arrows.
Riddled with arrows.
Yeah. And did not die briefly.
Yes.
And it is pointed that the guys at the start also got shot with arrows because again, this is all about Saint Sebastian.
Yeah.
But yes, he sees someone running through the bog. Right. And so he follows this idea, like this ghost of the person, and he winds up sinking into quicksand. Right. And he's like, and luckily Peter is there to save him.
Yes.
And so he looks down and he says, okay, this is where it is. Get the shovels. And so they dig and they dig and they dig and they find another bog man who, just like the other one, is perfectly preserved.
But, please. He has the hand.
Exactly. We see the pouch. They open up the pouch. And inside is the hand of Saint Sebastian. They have succeeded in finding it after all of these years.
Yep.
After literally a millennium, they have managed to find it. Because Peter explains in the story as they're going out there that effectively they thought that, like, the church thought this was a heresy.
Yes.
Right? That the belief that this hand could give you the communication, the understanding of the end of the world was a heresy that they could not permit. And the group was almost destroyed because not only did the church, decide to hunt down its members, but they offered an impossibly large bounty for anyone who would recover the hand. So actually members started turning on each other.
Yes.
And hence the snake you don't see.
Yes.
Right? It's all right there. Like, they keep reinforcing that idea that, you know, you can't trust anybody anymore. Not when the hand of Saint Sebastian is in play. But now they have recovered it. But the cops show up and arrest Peter Watts.
But Frank has the hand.
No, Frank has the hand, of course. They arrest Peter Watts for, you know, murdering that doctor. Because that's what they think happened. I mean, quite understandably.
Yeah.
Like, you get why they think that. Oh, and so now Frank and Cheryl have to figure out what to do. And so Frank confirms to Cheryl that he's got the hand, and he knows that Peter is being set up because he couldn't possibly have done it. They must have killed him right away. And so he sets up a meeting with Cheryl that night.
Yes.
And when he meets with Cheryl, they get ambushed by the murderers.
Yep.
And then he leads Cheryl to the hand. And then, of course, Cheryl pulls a gun on Frank because she is, of course, betrayed the group.
She is the snake in the grass.
Because they've been setting that up the entire episode.
Yeah.
Like, of course, somebody had to, and Cheryl's the only person there, so there you go. And we find out that, of course, this was a setup by the German cops.
Yeah.
With Frank. Because Brian, like, they realized, once they saw that he was in the hospital, that this lead to finding out that he was alive, right, that drove them down that path, was because he had been online with the porn star. But he was in the hospital. He couldn't have been online with the porn star. And so they had Brian check out who made the connection from his account via what phone line, and it was from Cheryl's cell phone.
Yep.
And that's how Frank knew they had been betrayed. So it's like it all closes up very neatly.
Yes. Very, very neatly. It's not left. There's nothing psychic about it.
No. This one is all just good detective work.
Yep. Except to finding the body.
Except for finding the body. That was 100% psychic abilities. Oh my God. But it's, I mean, unfortunately, we are sad that Cheryl has betrayed them, obviously.
Yes, but.
We will get more into that a little later on. The idea of what the alternate forces is. But they need it, and you might be saying, why go to all this trouble? Well, it's actually quite logical. They tried to beat the location out of the guy, and he wouldn't give it up. So they needed, him to tell the location to someone they trusted. So they needed to lead Frank and Peter to the guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, like logically, every part of this story tracks completely. No one is doing something just for the plot to move forward.
Yeah.
Like every part of this works. And so we end with Frank and Peter going over the corpse and looking at the fact that it is covered in tattoos and wondering like what this body can tell them.
Yep.
Right. What can this body tell us about, you know, what is coming? And of course we don't know because that's where the episode ends. Okay. But yeah, it's interesting because the guy gets killed with arrows, right? We are supposed to literally link this body's martyrdom to the death of Saint Sebastian. Yeah. And that he is, in a sense, by protecting the hand and dying in the same way, he is a martyr to the Millennium Group.
Yes.
It's a really interesting idea. And just the idea that, like, this episode just ends with this consideration in them looking over a 1,000-year-old corpse and wondering what it means is just so significant to how the show refuses to ever end things with any easy answers or even definitive answers. Like the bad guys have been caught and we've got the hand of Saint Sebastian now, but we're left with the question, okay, but what does any of that mean?
What's gonna happen now? Why did they need to find the hand?
Exactly. It's important to Peter. It's important to the group. Although, you know, some in the group didn't want him to bother searching it out. And, you know, there are other...
More snakes in the grass.
More snakes in the grass. Well, it's owls and roosters, as we'll find out in like 3 weeks.
Yeah. But, you know.
But that's another conversation. That's a conversation we'll have in 3 weeks. But yeah, like, this is, like, it's... It's such a tightly written thriller episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's them doing a 70s style spy thriller, Robert Ludlum type of deal with globe trotting and mysterious backgrounds and technological searches and betrayal and cars exploding. Like but it's all so tightly written. I'm kind of amazed by just how much content they managed to cram into this 45-minute episode.
Yeah, it is. The car blowing up, we don't have, like, it is interesting. It is tight, and that's all there, and it just tells you that there's an awful lot of fluff in a lot of other
shows we watch, yeah.
Robert Ludlum is probably actually the good,
comparison point,
yeah.
Yeah, because
like... You know, the Bourne Identity, everybody.
Yes, if you're not familiar with Robert Ludlum, he was a very big, spy potboiler writer in the, 70s. In the 70s and 80s.
The 80s, yeah.
Ipcris File.
Oh, yeah. Oh, geez, with Michael Caine.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah. Was he the Iger Sanction?
Yep.
Iger Sanction, Osterman Weekend, like just... Wonderful books.
Yeah.
Like really tight thrillers.
And all the movies that they made from them.
Oh, so many. Like, I would say that if you count in TV movies, which you have to, because TV movies used to be a thing, it would not surprise me if like 80% of his work was adapted for the screen or something insane like that.
Oh yeah, because it works. And I mean, the original Bourne Identity was with Richard Chamberlain.
Yep. Really, really good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. But. And the Bourne Identity spin-off, they were fine. But, you know, we love the classic Bourne Identity. We're purists. But that is the tone this has, Right? Yeah. It just has that feeling of this race against the clock to discover this thing, and there are conspiratorial forces out to get you. Like, this episode, like, the only problem with this episode is it's so tight. That's like, there's nothing for us to criticize.
No.
Like, I don't know what choice you would have done differently at any part of this episode.
Well, it's the same thing with the previous episode.
Yeah. They're just incredibly tightly written episodes. Like, this is television as good as it gets. And again, how many cast members are there in the previous? Well, it's just him and Peter Watts. And then in the previous episode, Laura was there. And then this episode, Brian was there. But they're not like, and again, I mean, I know I criticize this too much, but it's like, they're not desperate. Okay, well, we have to find 3 minutes to service every character every week. Well, when you got 8 characters, that's 24 minutes of your show.
Yep.
You know, that's half of your show. Here, because Brian is only there to serve the rule, like the stuff that Brian needs to do, just like the previous episode, Laura was only there to offer some insight from her point of view, but we don't have to get into a lot of it because it's not a Laura episode, you know? And they have a character who has a special skill. You bring them in to do that special skill, and then we move on with the plot.
Yes. This one was both of them. That's what I was thinking. I was looking at the clock and going, well, geez, this is going to be one of our shorter episodes, finally.
I know.
Simply because you can't complain, and it's pretty clear what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
Once you get to the end of each of these episodes.
Yeah.
Even though it leaves it up in the air to some extent, is biblical prophecy coming true?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this whole thing with the hand of Sebastian, what's that going to mean? Okay, yes, those are all left open, but this is a serial show, so
we know that they're going to come back to it.
They're going to come back to it. We now trust them. They will come back to all of the things that need to be come back to.
Yeah, they historically have been very good at that.
Yeah, and, you know, so far we're into episode 8. I'm going, what the hell was Chris Carter's problem?
I don't know. It's just a really great show week to week.
So far, yeah, so far this season is just out of the ballpark the way we remembered it.
I gotta say, here's how good this show is. Right? And I know this is a weird thing to point out, but, we're not even criticizing them to 3 episodes apart, both involving digging up ancient corpses, that are of religious significance.
Yeah.
Because that happened in a single blade of grass, and now it's happening in the hand of Saint Sebastian.
No.
But the contexts are so completely different that you would never for a second think, oh no, they're going back to the well. Because it feels so utterly different.
Yes, it is so utterly different.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, we are still talking about the apocalypse. Right? I mean, everything connects, it's all about the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it is not about the Christian apocalypse, it tells us the 3 episodes back that there is apocalyptic thought elsewhere.
Yeah. No, it is really interesting that they're saying that in each of these communities or each of these cultures, they all have their own ideas of the end.
Oh yeah.
And as you say, even the fact that the sun goes down every day instills the idea that things have to come to an end. As you know, setting aside the concept of human life ending, but just even the fact that the sun goes down every day is an end and a beginning every single day as a metaphor. So of course every culture is going to have their own expansive ideas of that.
Yeah.
Oh, and to be clear, in case this episode didn't make it clear enough, this whole idea of the church cracking down and massacring them in betrayal, the Millennium Group are the Knights Templar.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, in case you don't know, we haven't mentioned it up until this point because we were, I think, waiting for this episode, but all of the mythology of the Knights Templar is the Millennium Group. Right. I mean, and we're not saying that, in the world of the show, and it's basically, I don't know if the Knights Templar ever get mentioned, but the idea is in the world of the show, instead of the Knights Templar happening, there was the Millennium Group.
Yeah.
And unlike the Knights Templar, who were just a bank, and then the French king realized he owed too much money to the bank, so he just decided to take over the bank and kill everybody who worked there and take their money, and he split the money with Rome, so Rome was fine with it. And then of course we developed 600 years of conspiracies about why that happened.
Yeah.
In the world of Millennium, all of the conspiracy stuff was true, and they were killed for, you know, mysterious conspiracy reasons.
There you go.
But yeah, that's the true story of what happened to the Knights Templar. If a king owes you too much money, the king might decide just to, you know,
kill you.
Might just decide that it's easier to kill you than to pay it back. If you watch the, if you watch The Sopranos, that was a thing that came up a lot.
And then there's the,
don't lend too much money to a mobster, because at some point he might kill you rather than paying it back.
Yeah. Well, what happens is, I was thinking about the, all of the ones with Tom Hanks, right? The Angels and Demons.
And oh, yes.
It was the third one, right, that gets into this mess.
No, I think it's the second one. I think it's Angels and Demons that starts talking about the Templars.
Yeah, okay.
Inferno's the third one. Inferno, the one nobody saw.
Yeah, I have seen it.
I haven't even seen Inferno. Oh, you haven't?
Well, it shows up every now and then, either on A&E or on Sci-Fi.
Okay, so yeah, you just flip it on in the background. But yeah, we're going to have more to talk about with the Templars when we get to, Owls and Roosters. Mm-hmm. In the second half of the season, because that's where they really start getting into this. And it frustrates me that, like, you watch the first season, which is as interesting and tight a serial killer show as you're going to watch.
Mm-hmm.
That has high aspirations and it exceeds them. And then you get to season two and they start getting into the Christian apocrypha, right?
Yeah.
And they start really, and you're like, oh no, it's even getting better. Like, this show could have gone off the rails, but we're halfway through the season and it's better than ever.
Yeah.
And you really start getting frustrated and thinking, oh God, if only they had had the chance to finish this story that they were telling.
Yeah.
And by the way, I saw some reference in the trivia for one of the episodes of Millennium and IMDb. Even though the show was canceled, you know, long before the Millennium, they got a chance to wrap it up in an X-Files episode. Long before the Millennium? The show was canceled 7 months before the Millennium.
Wait, come on.
Like, season 1, 96 to 97. Season 2, 97 to 98. Season 3, 98 to 99. The show was only supposed to run 4 seasons, everybody. They could have just given them that last 13 episodes. No. How dare you give them the last 13 episodes to wrap this up? All right. So, next week we are going to be watching my personal favorite episode of the show.
Jose
Chung's Doomsday Defense.
And then Midnight
of the Century. Yeah, which is very interesting because it gets into, which is the like family stuff.
Yeah.
Jordan's gift that they hinted at in the first season starts getting explored here.
Yeah.
But, and it's an interesting one to pair with Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. But like, Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, for a quick explanation, if you're not familiar with The X-Files, if this is your first thing, The X-Files is a very old show at this point. Like, when I was growing up, for someone growing up today, The X-Files is as old as Dragnet was to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how old The X-Files is. It started 30 years ago, right?
Yep.
So that is how old a show, well, I guess not Dragnet, but Perry Mason was to me. Like, that's how old we're talking about. So it's understandable if you don't know about this, but Glenn Morgan and James Wong worked on that show. And Glenn Morgan's brother is Darren Morgan. And Darren Morgan is an unheralded genius. Because he's a writer who's a talented writer. He wrote a couple of just regular episodes of The X-Files. The one where William Sanderson is getting like messages through the through screens telling him to kill people. And it's the idea is that the government is like trying to create mass shooters for some reason. He wrote that one. He wrote the wonderful, what's it called? Clyde Bruckman's Last Repose. The one with Peter Boyle as a man who knows how everyone's going to die.
It's
such a beautiful episode of television. It's what many people say is the best episode of The X-Files. But what he was best at was looking at The X-Files as a whole and finding what to critique about it. And they allowed him to do that in a comedy episode. And that comedy episode was Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
Yep.
Which is just a masterpiece. Asking, okay, well, I mean, enough people we've established in this world that, you know, certain people know about Fox Mulder and know about the X-Files, know about UFOs. So what if Truman Capote showed up and wrote a book about an X-File? Wrote one of his true crime books about an X-File. And that is the show. And it is a brilliant episode. And so the two of them, and that's said, okay, Darren, Morgan, try to do that for Millennium as well. And yeah. That is what we watch next. Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. When you watch it, you will see why this is, for me, one of the most pivotal episodes of television I've ever watched.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
But we're going to talk about that next week. but yeah, so, and he also did Somehow the Devil Got Behind Me, which is another masterpiece episode. It is on the short list for being the best episode of Millennium as well.
Yeah.
Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. Oh my God, that episode. So yeah, there's a lot of high points left in the season to talk about.
Yeah, that was, Bill Macy was in that.
Yeah, Bill Macy. Now that's not William H. Macy. It's Bill Macy, the husband from Maude.
Yes.
Yeah, just to be clear. Yeah, that's why we have to say that's literally why we have to say William H. Macy, because under the union, you can't have two actors with the exact same name. Yeah, he's called William H. Macy because Bill Macy was an existing actor who was prominent. All right. So that is that though for now. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if there's any profiling related fiction you'd like us to check out, please be sure to drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you have, if you're listening to this on an app or a podcatcher, please be sure to rate and review. That's how people find out about the show. We'll see you back here next week for my favorite episode of Millennium and Midnight of the Century. But until then, I'll say that's right. Au revoir.
Have a good week.